Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week. You're listening Post for Politics, Iowa style, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. We are glad you are with us. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, we were off last week. We're here tonight. It is good to have you back.
Yes, good to talk with you, Dennis.
We have a ton of things to talk about tonight. But first, since this program is called Capital Week, we ought to tell you what went on at the Iowa State Capitol in Des Moines yesterday, Sunday, especially since it relates to our lead story. The Des Moines Register counted thousands of protesters gathered at the state capitol. They held up signs that read, "Bans off our bodies and my body, my choice." Nearly a dozen abortion rights groups had organized that event, including Planned Parenthood, the Iowa Abortion Access Fund, and the Emma Goldman Clinic. Speakers encourage those in attendance to vote for candidates who support abortion access and donate to organizations that help people, women, pay for abortions. Since we were on the air 2 weeks ago, Governor Reynolds had announced that she was asking for two legal do-overs, hoping to accelerate severe restrictions on abortions. One of those do-overs involving asking the state Supreme Court, in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision giving states the right to decide on abortions, to rehear one of the recent Iowa cases. She was hoping the majority of the court would adopt a new legal standard. Well, the Iowa Supreme Court denied one of those requests last week. Laura, what was that all about?
Yeah, so if you remember, in June, we talked about the Iowa Supreme Court's big decision, majority ruling that reversed its 2018 precedent. So the court said, while considering that 24-hour waiting period for abortions, it said that the Iowa Constitution does not protect abortion as a fundamental right. And they sent the case back to lower court to be heard, and they did not establish a new legal standard for determining whether an abortion restriction violates the Constitution. So the majority opinion said that the U.S. Supreme Court will soon release its opinion in Dobbs. This is the case related to the Mississippi 15-week abortion ban. And it said that while we, the Iowa Supreme Court, have the independent authority to interpret the Iowa Constitution, we do sometimes take into account the wisdom and the arguments advanced by the U.S. Supreme Court. So a week after the Iowa Supreme Court's decision came down, the U.S. Supreme Court came out and reversed the Roe v. Wade precedent and completely eliminated any federal constitutional right to an abortion nationwide. So the governor went to the Iowa Supreme Court. This is any litigant who has a case before the Iowa Supreme Court has 2 weeks following the Iowa Supreme Court's decisions to ask for a rehearing. And the governor said, look, you said that the Dobbs opinion might have insight that you were lacking. The U.S. Supreme Court came out with a Dobbs opinion and said that there is no constitutional right to an abortion. Any restrictions should be subject to just a rational basis test. That is the lowest bar for the government to clear. And she asked the Iowa Supreme Court to come back and say that any abortion restrictions in Iowa should be subject to only a rational basis review. That would virtually guarantee that almost any restriction on abortion would pass legal muster, because courts almost always uphold laws and regulations when they're using what's called a rational basis standard. All the government has to show is that they had some legitimate reason for the policy. So normally the Iowa Supreme Court does not approve these requests for rehearings, but I thought there was a chance that they might do so in this case because the majority opinion had left the door open in this to possibly being influenced by what the U.S. Supreme Court did with Dobbs. But in fact, the Iowa Supreme Court came back last week and said, no, we're not rehearing this case. It goes back to district court, and the parties can argue over what is the proper standard for evaluating abortion restrictions. And that's very important because it means that Planned Parenthood and the other litigants, the ACLU, they can continue to argue that Iowa should have some kind of standard that is similar to the federal, it used to be the federal Casey standard, which is, do abortion restrictions provide, do they impose an undue burden on people seeking an abortion? And that is a balancing test where the courts would weigh the government's interest in reducing abortions versus the individual's interest in having bodily autonomy. So in that kind of a scenario, the courts might uphold a 24-hour waiting period, but perhaps they would strike down a more broad-based abortion ban. Of course, the state will be arguing for a rational basis standard that would allow anything up to and including a total ban on abortion.
Okay, so this is obviously very confusing to most people out there about what's going on legally. Let's bottom line this on this case. You wrote on Bleeding Heartland after the state Supreme Court decision that it could mean it might be years before the state Supreme Court in Iowa determines whether the Constitution guarantees any level of bodily autonomy for pregnant Iowans. So let's explain that.
Yes, because the Iowa Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to rehear this case and decide this quickly. We're sending it back to district court. So that means both sides now have a few months to produce their briefs and argue in district court. It will probably take a few months for the district court to rule one way or the other on the 24-hour waiting period. And then regardless of the ruling, the losing side is going to appeal that to the Iowa Supreme Court. That generally involves several more months of time for the parties to submit briefs and responses to each other's briefs. And then there would be more oral arguments. So we're probably looking at late 2023, possibly not even until 2024, before the Iowa Supreme Court would hear this case and determine what is the appropriate standard. Is it something like an undue burden standard, or is it more like a rational basis standard? So what it means is the Republican trifecta in Iowa cannot quickly pass an abortion ban and be confident that courts will uphold that ban.
Now, this was part one of the governor's two-part plan to try to get more restrictions on abortion. She also announced that she plans to ask a Polk County District Court to lift an injunction, and I'm going to say this very carefully here so that we can understand this easily, to lift an injunction blocking the state's so-called fetal heartbeat law, which was enacted in 2008. Let's dig into that. I'm sorry, 2018. Let's dig into that.
Okay, so just the big 30,000-foot view. Asking the Iowa Supreme Court for a rehearing was a long shot, but it was within the range of things that can happen legally. This other gambit is much more unusual. And in fact, some attorneys I talked to about said that there really shouldn't be any legal path for this to even be possible. So they don't really see how this could happen. But the governor in 2018, the governor signed a law that its proponents call it the heartbeat bill. Other people call it the 6-week ban. It would ban most abortions in Iowa after any fetal cardiac activity could be detected. And that law was quickly struck down in Polk County District Court. And the governor, like any litigant in Iowa, has 30 days to appeal a district court decision and opted in January of 2019 not to appeal that decision. So in theory, that was the final resolution of that case. The Polk County District Court declared that law was unconstitutional. It was permanently enjoined, and it should be gone. So in theory, there should be no way to bring that law back to life. But the governor is going to argue in court, she hasn't filed the motion yet, but the governor is going to argue that this law was struck down under the Iowa Supreme Court precedent that no longer is valid because the Iowa Supreme Court overturned their own precedent. And so she's going to argue that they should be able to go back and lift the injunction on this law. Again, I have talked to a lot of attorneys about this, and really, if you miss your 30-day window to appeal, you don't really get to go back years later and ask the court to revisit that decision, even if the decision was wrong. So we'll see. It would be very surprising to me if a court goes for this option that the governor is going to be seeking.
So after all of this, the bottom line is still that Iowa law, or rather abortion, is still legal in Iowa under the law.
Yes, up to 20 weeks of pregnancy, abortion is still legal. A 24-hour waiting period is now in effect. There are some other regulations as well. For instance, an ultrasound is required. That's been required for years in Iowa. But yes, abortion is still legal. It will remain legal for the foreseeable future. And it's not clear when the governor is going to officially even ask a court to revisit this injunction on the 2018 law. But it also means that the legislature is not going to quickly try to pass a new abortion ban modeled on what some other states are enacting right now.
In fact, the governor has said she has no plans to call Iowa lawmakers back to the Capitol for a special session this year.
Yes, she said this is the way to go. We're going to try to bring back this law that we already passed and get it back on the books and in effect. And when reporters asked her last week, well, what's your ultimate goal for abortion? She dodged. She didn't want to answer the question. So it's very possible that next year during the legislative session, if the governor is reelected and if Republicans maintain control of both chambers, they could come back and try to pass a brand new law that's even more restrictive than the 2018 law. But it sounds like there is no appetite within the Republican caucuses in the Iowa House and Senate to take a vote like that before the November election.
So while all of this legal jujitsu is going on, Democratic State Attorney General Tom Miller says he is not going to represent the state in the governor's efforts to limit access to abortion. Normally, the state attorney general would do so, but he's recused himself.
Yes, this is rare. I think as Tom Miller has been attorney general for almost 40 years, and there have only been a handful of times that he refused to represent the state or recused himself for some reason. I recall that his office declined to represent the state in the litigation, the Varnum of the Breen case about marriage equality. And also he recused himself from the case related to the collective bargaining law. But in this case, it was similar to after the 2018 abortion ban was passed. He actually refused to defend it at that time. The state hired outside counsel to defend that law and unsuccessfully attempt to defend that law. But Tom Miller released a statement that said he's not going along with this legal strategy. He believes that this is not correct, that there is a constitutional right to an abortion. And so the governor quickly was able to line up other attorneys. Alan Ostergren, who is a top Republican attorney in the state, he is leading the team. There are also people representing other law firms outside the state who have been involved in similar litigation elsewhere.
So Iowa's Republican legislative leaders, of course, support the governor's plans. Iowa Democratic leaders, of course, denounced her moves. What's really interesting is that abortion providers are saying that they're seeing a lot of new calls from people really confused about how to access an abortion. One Planned Parenthood leader said patients are confused and scared. That is certainly not unexpected, because what's been going on statewide and nationally is, to put it bluntly, a mess.
Yes. And the very day the Iowa Supreme Court's decision came out, there was a virtual press conference that Planned Parenthood held. And that was the top thing that they kept emphasizing, is that abortion is still legal. They were already getting calls even then, before the U.S. Supreme Court had overturned Roe. Formerly, the people were very worried. There was confusion about whether this 2018 law might go back into effect. And even though it isn't, that was something a lot of people were worried about. And yes, there is confusion. And I think that will remain, especially given there's a lot of media coverage of things going on in other states that already have enacted very severe abortion bans on the books. And that's causing a lot of other confusion related to medical care, reproductive care. So I think that this is just going to be a period that will be difficult for a lot of people to navigate. But yes, it is. The abortion providers have said that this is something they're prepared to keep providing abortions as long as it's legal in Iowa. Planned Parenthood in Iowa is part of the affiliate that's called Planned Parenthood North Central States. And the Minnesota affiliate, rather, is already making plans for an influx of patients from North and South Dakota, potentially from Wisconsin, and possibly from Iowa and Nebraska in the future if those states also enact abortion bans.
Meanwhile, President Biden, who's been heavily criticized by members of his own party for not responding quickly enough, vigorously enough, a lot of unhappiness among the left wing of the Democratic Party. On Friday, he signed an executive order that seeks to safeguard access to abortion medication and emergency contraception and to protect patient privacy. He talked about all of that. It's unclear how exactly he's going to do it, but he's talking about it.
He's talking about it, but, you know, it's the Biden administration is clearly in a bind because they don't seem to want to pick a fight with the U.S. Supreme Court. There are a lot of activists within the Democratic Party and the reproductive rights advocates. They would like to see a much more aggressive stance, sign executive orders, pass the law codifying Roe v. Wade. And if the U.S. Supreme Court later strikes that down, so be it. Then you use that as part of a broader campaign to try to achieve your goals in other ways, possibly by expanding the Supreme Court. But it seems like the Biden administration doesn't want to do things that will put it in direct conflict with the U.S. Supreme Court right now. But it is an issue. I mean, I was just reading a new report from Louisiana Today that there are certain drugs that can be used to induce an abortion. They're also used for other conditions. And there are doctors now finding that pharmacies won't issue that drug, or they're having problems getting approval for that drug because of concerns that it could be used for an abortion. So it's definitely a realistic concern that this could be interfering with other types of care.
Maybe we should call this the summer of our discontent.
Yes. I mean, it's really, people are unhappy on the left, but I think that partly that's because there aren't a lot of good, easy options. I mean, people have said, you know, the president needs to establish federally operated abortion clinics. I mean, that would be very difficult to get up and running. There are, I think, things that he could do related to the post office. But I mean, if states are going to try to ban certain types of medications within the state, I definitely think there will be some kind of legal showdown in court over it, because there's, and it's also some states that are considering restrictions on travel to another state for purposes of an abortion. I mean, there is a long established federal constitutional right to travel, but I think that may be tested by some of the state laws that are being considered.
I should point out that the summer of our discontent, I just made that up. The winter of our discontent is the title of a book by John Steinbeck. So we always try to bring in some literary stuff on this show.
That's good.
It is 16 minutes after the hour, wherever you're listening to us. Hope you're having a good time like we are. You're in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. And boy, there's a lot going on. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bell, and we're here every week, except on the 4th of July weekend, at this time to talk about politics, Iowa style, and how it's affecting all of us. Okay, we have zipped through 16 and a half minutes of this show. Now, let's do the rest of it. There's a new poll out, an internal poll from Mike Franken, who's the Democrat running against Chuck Grassley for the U.S. Senate seat. This poll, I don't know if you can call it shocking or surprising. Laura, let's go into it. But is it shocking? Is it surprising? And is it credible?
I think it is shocking. Every election forecaster considers Iowa's Senate race safe, solid Republican. So zero chance of Chuck Grassley losing. And yet Mike Franken, the Democratic nominee's campaign, is out with a poll that showed the first time respondents were asked the question about who would they vote for in the Senate race if it were today, 49% said Grassley, 44% said Mike Franken. Then a number of other questions and statements were read and asked. Biographies, short biographies of each candidates were read. And when they asked a second time, 47% said they would support Chuck Grassley and 46% said Franken. That would be within the poll's margin of error. So that almost by definition, I mean, if that is a reflection of reality, you can't say that that's a safe race for a candidate if they're only leading by single digits and if their reelect number is below 50%. Usually incumbents like to see the reelect number comfortably above 50%. Now, I should say, again, an internal poll is a poll commissioned by the campaign. And so it would be much better to have an independent poll commissioned by some news organization, but there aren't nearly as many of those as there used to be. Chuck Grassley's campaign has presumably been doing its own polling, but they have not released any numbers. So we don't know whether their snapshots look anything like what the Franken campaign released, or whether they show Senator Grassley comfortably ahead. And remember also that the Franken campaign didn't release all of the numbers from this poll. They only released some of the numbers. So it's always healthy to be skeptical about internal polls. But it was realistic in the sense that other portions of the poll, for instance, when they asked the respondents, how did you vote in the 2020 election? It was about 45% said Biden. That was very similar to Biden's share of the vote in 2020 in Iowa. When they asked about whether you approve of the job Joe Biden is doing, it was only 33% approve, 59% disapprove. That is in line with the Des Moines Register's polls over the last 6 months to a year about Biden's approval. So it wasn't a skewed pro-democratic sample of respondents by any means. So it's not a poll that I would dismiss out of hand, but I would want to see some kind of independent confirmation of those numbers before I would say it's a single digit race between Grassley and Franken.
I think everybody would be more comfortable, probably even the Franken campaign, if the Des Moines Register's poll came out with something in the next few weeks or so, just to see if this is anywhere close to reality.
And, you know, the Register used to do a lot more polls than they do now. They've cut back their budget like many other news organizations. They used to have, in election years, they would have polls in May, July, September, October, and then the weekend before the election. And now they often only do a poll. They did one in March. They never announced their schedule in advance. So they may do one this month or they may not do one until September. So it could be a long time before we have any idea how close the Senate race or the governor's race is. And of course, it would be better yet if we had several different media organizations commissioning polls instead of just Ann Seltzer for the Des Moines Register. She is an excellent pollster, but even the best pollsters have some misses.
And speaking of polls we haven't heard about, Governor Reynolds. We know that in the Des Moines Register poll months ago, she was 7 or 8 points ahead of Deidre Dejir, her Democratic opponent, but we haven't heard anything since. And we know that she's done some internal polling, but those have not been released.
That's right. And a lot of people have been asking me, how close is this governor's race? And the Dejir campaign has been sending out fundraising emails saying, this is close. We need your support. So is it really close? The answer is we don't know. That poll from the Des Moines Register is the only public poll that I'm aware of this campaign. It was in the field more than 4 months ago. Deidre Dejir was not well known at all. Only about 31% of the sample even knew enough about her to have an opinion. And they were about evenly divided on whether they supported her. And yet, in the ballot test, 51% said that they would vote to reelect Kim Reynolds if the election were today, and 43% said they would vote for Deidre Dejir. And I just remember that was, I've never seen anything like that poll that showed 43% said they would vote for Dejir. And of those people who said they would support Dejir, 61% said they didn't know enough about Dejir to have an opinion. And yet they said they were ready to vote for Dejir. So I interpret that as more of people saying I'm against Kim Reynolds than for Deidre Dejir, because they really didn't know anything about the candidate. And the Dejir campaign hasn't had a lot of money to spend to raise her name ID. So I don't know that her name ID is much higher now than it would have been in February and March. But I do know from looking at the campaign finance disclosures that the Reynolds campaign did pay a Republican research firm about $56,000 for polling in May. Those numbers have not been released. Now, it doesn't mean that the race is close. There could be reasons for a campaign to hold back numbers. But usually, if an incumbent has an internal poll that shows them doing very well, you know, 20 points ahead or way above the 50% reelect number, usually they would try to release that poll or partial results from the poll just to demoralize the opposition.
Okay, let's talk about Cindy Axne, Democratic 3rd Congressional District incumbent. She released a second television ad against Republican opponent Zach Nunn a couple of weeks ago. This one is similar to an ad released earlier in June. This time around, the new Axne ad went further than the first one, citing a list of injuries, deaths, and safety violations over the years at Adventureland, tying that in to donations that Adventureland's then owners made to Zach Nunn years ago. KCCI-TV fact-checked this one, as it did the first one, found it is absolutely inaccurate. What's going on with Cindy Axne?
Okay, well, one thing that we know is that we haven't seen any polls released on the third district race, but we know that Cindy Axne's numbers can't be good in the Democratic polling because an incumbent never comes right out of the gate with negative ads if they're starting in a strong position. So that's one thing we do know. We know the national ratings, forecasters, all of them changed their forecast from toss-up to lean Republican after Zach Nunn won the GOP primary. And in fact, 538.com just came out with new ratings, and they only give Cindy Axne about a 1 in 4 chance of being reelected. It's a really tough race for her. Now, I don't know, of course, anything about the internal deliberations on why they chose to go first with this Adventureland issue, particularly when the first ad was criticized and then they came out with a second ad on the Adventureland issue. I don't know what the strategy is there. I think normally a campaign would come out with an attack that they would hope would be rock solid. So Zach Nunn has been in the legislature since 2015. He's taken a lot of votes on a lot of bills. So I would have expected the Axne campaign to come out with ads attacking some of the votes he's taken. And it could be that they have those planned for later. But for instance, abortion being an issue that everybody is talking about right now, Zach Nunn voted for that 2018 law that would have banned almost all abortions after 6 weeks. So that I was surprised to see the Adventureland donations and Adventureland ride safety record come in, because that really isn't an area that Zach Nunn had any control over as a state legislator.
Okay, we'll be following that as well. Now let's talk about Sonja Heitschusen. A Democratic state house candidate has been charged with reckless use of a firearm. We're talking about Sonja Heitschusen. Police said she shot a gun through a sliding glass door in her home last week. Now, she's running in House District 28, which includes parts of West Des Moines, Van Meter, and Adel. Said she's received threats over the years because of her previous career as an anchor on WHO-TV. Okay, so she has been charged with reckless use of a firearm. What kind of potential impact are we talking about on her campaign?
Well, I mean, normally that would be a very bad thing for any candidate to have any kind of criminal charge during a campaign. So it's clearly not good. I mean, I think it depends on how quickly it's resolved and whether her not guilty plea is upheld. Talking with some attorneys about this, there was a little bit of confusion because it's not clear whether the police are claiming that this discharge of the firearm was deliberate. Normally, with the crime that she's being charged with, there would have to be some kind of deliberate firing of the shot rather than an accidental shot. So it's not really clear why somebody would deliberately shoot out their own glass window in their own house. And it's not clear whose firearm it was. So I think that, I mean, there are a lot more facts need to come out, but clearly this is not something going into a general election campaign. This is not something any candidate wants, to have a criminal charge. Again, this is a district that's a very competitive district on paper, about split down the middle on Biden versus Trump. David Young, the former member of Congress from the 3rd District, is the Republican candidate. This is a district that includes part of those suburbs and some other rural and small town areas in Dallas County. So again, Sonja Heitschusen is going to have to hope that this is something that's resolved. The sooner, the better that it's resolved. I think that then we'll know whether her campaign can survive it.
Right, something this former TV anchor would not like to see on television. There's no question about that.
I mean, it's certainly true that women who work in television sometimes have to deal with threats and stalkers. I mean, that's something I know just from talking with other women, on-air talent and television news. Unfortunately, it is something that sometimes comes with the territory. But it sounded like from the reports that this was not actually her weapon that was fired. So not clear exactly what the circumstances were.
We have about 2 minutes left. So on Friday, back in D.C., here we are talking again about the Democratic National Committee. The Rules and Bylaws Committee got together again. Not much done this time around, but the Des Moines Register, made a pretty big deal about this one, about whether Iowa should remain first in the nation in terms of the presidential nominating process in 2024. What really came out of this meeting on Friday?
Well, I mean, I think, again, that Iowa has an uphill battle. The DNC is going to be looking to spread around these early states regionally. So they're going to look to have something in the Northeast, something in the South, something in the Midwest, and something in the West. And it sounds like Nevada and New Hampshire are in a relatively secure position. They're both swing states in their regions. And South Carolina looks like could be facing a pretty serious competition from Georgia. But Iowa is looking at competition from Minnesota, Michigan, other Midwestern states that are arguably more competitive than this state is, and states that hold primaries, not caucuses, which even with the changes Iowa is willing to make, caucuses still limit participation more than a primary election. So I would still say the odds are stacked against Iowa, but they have an opportunity to keep trying to have these conversations with DNC members. And in theory, we're all going to find out next month what they decide for the count.
And one more note here, the Cedar Rapids Gazette said last week that new state revenue numbers in Iowa show we're likely to see another budget surplus. So Republicans who control the legislature use that surplus to justify a tax cut this year. You see another one coming next year?
Very possible. I mean, it's something that the governor, I mean, usually that is the standard play whenever there's a budget surplus, that Republicans, when they're in control of the legislature and the governor's office, will cut taxes. They don't, when there's a shortfall, the services tend to be cut rather than taxes increase. So I think it's possible. I think it's not clear exactly which taxes will be cut. They really cut income taxes to quite a significant degree. I have heard some discussions about some kind of swap where certain taxes would be reduced and maybe the sales tax would be increased to take care of that natural resources trust fund. That's an idea that's always kicking around the legislature, but never seems to go anywhere, kind of like the bottle bill. which finally did move this year.
But I
absolutely would not rule out more tax cuts next year if Republicans maintain a trifecta control of government and if there is a surplus. Again, a lot of the surplus is related to the federal spending, the American Rescue Plan, and the earlier spending for the COVID-19 relief funds. And that is not going to be around forever. Most of that funding will dry up in 2026. But in the meantime, state legislatures might have some big surpluses to deal with.
We're out of time, Laura. See you next week.
Okay. See you then, Dennis.
You've been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Really out of time. We hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy week. And bye-bye.